who always had a ready smile and something new from his oven that he could use to distract the soldiers who sometimes came into the bakery to ask too many questions. The soldier reached into his pocket, and I screamed. I threw my arms around Daria and pulled her down to the floor with me. I knew he was reaching for his gun, and I was going to die. Without ever having fallen in love, or finished my book, or studied at university, or held my own baby in my arms. But there was no gunshot. Instead, the soldier cleared his throat. When I was brave enough to squint up at him, I saw that he was holding out a business card. Tiny and cream-colored, it said, Erich Schaefer, Stuttgart Ballet. I was the artistic director there before the occupation, he said. If your friend would like to come to me for pointers, I would be happy to provide some. He inclined his head and left, closing the door behind him. Daria, who hadn't understood a word he'd said in German, took the card from my hand. What did he want from me? To give you dance lessons. Her eyes widened. You're kidding me. No. He used to work for the Stuttgart Ballet. Daria leaped to her feet and did a turn around the room, smiling so wide that I fell into the chasm of her happiness. But then, just as quickly, the light in her eyes burned hotter, angrier. So, I am good enough for lessons, but not good enough to walk down Zgierska Street? She ripped the business card in half and tossed it into the belly of the wood stove. At least it is something to burn, Daria said. In retrospect, it's amazing that Meyer, my little nephew, did not get sick before. With my sister and Reuben and six other couples in a tiny apartment, there was always someone coughing or sneezing or running a fever. Meyer, though, had been sturdy and adaptable, happy to be carried by Basha, or when he was old enough to be in a daycare center while she worked in a textile factory. This week, though, Basha had come to my mother, frantic. Meyer was coughing. He was running a fever. Last night he had not been able to catch his breath, and his lips had turned blue. It was late February 1941. My mother and Basha had stayed up all night with Meyer, taking turns holding him. They both had to go to work, though, or risk losing their jobs. With hundreds of people streaming into the ghetto daily from other countries, a worker was easily replaceable. Some people were being sent to work outside the ghetto. We didn't want to risk breaking our family apart. Because Meyer was sick, my father planned to send Reuben home from the bakery early. This was a big deal for several reasons. The most important ones being that my father did not really have the authority to do that. And that it meant one less man to transport the loaded bread cart to the distribution point storehouse at 4 Yakuba Street. Minka, my father announced that morning, you will come at noon and you will take Reuben's place. There were no schools anymore, so I had a job too, as a delivery girl for a leather goods factory that produced and repaired shoes, boots, belts, and holsters. Daria worked there with me. We were sent all over the ghetto on various errands or to make deliveries. It was believed that perhaps I might not be missed if I slipped away, or that if I was, Daria could cover for me for the afternoon. Secretly, I knew my father was thrilled to have me in his bakery. Reuben was not a baker by trade. He had been assigned to work with my father simply because they had been standing in line together to seek employment. Although it did not take an advanced university degree to bake bread, there was definitely an art to it, one that my father used to say I had in spades. I knew instinctively how much bread to pinch from the amorphous mass of dough in order to make a batard that was exactly 13 inches long. I could braid 6 strands of challah in my sleep. But Reuben, he was constantly messing up, mixing a dough that was too wet or too dry, daydreaming when he should have been using the peel to move the loaves in the brick oven before the bottom crusts burned. After running a midday errand, I slipped off to the bakery instead of returning to the shoe factory. I happened to catch sight of myself in the plate glass window of a fabrique where textiles were manufactured. At first I averted my eyes. That's what I did when I passed people on the street, mostly. It was just too sad to look at others, to see your own pain written across their faces. But then I realized that it was just my reflection, and yet oddly unfamiliar. The chubby cheeks and baby fat I'd carried around last year were gone. My cheekbones were sharp and angular, my eyes huge in my face, my hair, which had once been my pride and joy, long and thick, was matted and dry, hidden underneath my wool cap. I was skinny enough to be a ballerina, like Daria. I wondered how I hadn't noticed the weight slipping off me, or, for that matter, anyone else in my family. We were all starving all the time. Even with our extra bread ration, there was never enough food, and what there was spoiled, rotten, or rancid. As I walked into the bakery, I spied my father, stripped to his undershirt in front of the brick ovens, sweating in the blistering heat. His muscles were no longer beefy, just striated like rope. His belly was flat, his cheeks hollow. And yet, to me, he still seemed a commanding presence in the room, as he shouted directions to his workers and simultaneously shaped dough to rest on a plank. "Minusha," he said, his voice ringing out across the flowered table, "come help me over here." Reuben nodded at me and slipped off his apron. He had arranged with my father to leave through the back door of the bakery, but he wasn't going to announce his departure, lest someone else see it as a special favor. I stepped up beside my father and began to expertly rip pieces of dough and shape them into batards. "How was work today?" he asked. I shrugged. "The same. What news have you had about Meyer?" My father shook his head. "Nothing. But no news is good news." And that was all we said. Even talking took too much energy when we had a set number of loaves to produce before the transport to the warehouse. I thought instead of what it used to be like inside my father's own bakery, how sometimes he would sing in a scratchy baritone, and how Basha at the register would say he was scaring away customers. I remembered the way the light would slant inside at about 4:30 in the summer, when the sun was beginning to slip behind the buildings across the street, how I would curl up in the padded window seat with one of my schoolbooks and doze off, my stomach full from the roll my father had made me, cinnamon sugar dusting my skirt like glitter. How he would shake me awake, asking what he'd done to deserve such a lazy girl, smiling the whole time, so that I knew he meant the exact opposite. And I thought of Meyer, who had just learned to say my name. When it was nearly time for us to load the loaves into baskets and transport them to Yakuba Street, the door opened, letting in a flickering tongue of cold air. Reuben walked back into the bakery, his hands buried in his pockets, his chin ducked into the scarf wrapped around his neck. "Reuben," I said, my stomach flipping, "if he was here, it could only be to tell us something awful." He shook his head. "Nothing's changed," Reuben said. Basha and your mother are home now with Meyer. He turned to my father and shrugged. It was doing me no good to sit around there. Then grab a basket, my father said, squeezing Reuben's shoulder. Reuben and I and the other bakery employees began to load up the bread from the wire racks where it cooled. It was backbreaking work. Loaves weigh more than you'd think when packed tightly together. I ferried baskets from the bakery into the cart that was pulled up to the front door. Three little boys gathered on the stoop across the street. They were shivering, but they stood in the snow, stamping their feet for as long as we were out there. They could smell the steam and the flour, which was the next best thing to eating the bread itself. When it was full, my father walked behind the cart and pushed, while two of the stronger employees grabbed the yoke in the front to tug. He motioned to me to walk beside him because I hadn't the strength to pull. "Oh!" I cried out, remembering that I'd left my scarf wrapped around the neck of a chair inside. "I'll be right back." I ran into the bakery again to find Reuben still inside. He had unbuttoned his coat part way and was slipping a loaf beneath his clothing. Our eyes met. Bread smuggling was a crime. So was any speculation on the black market for foodstuffs. But sometimes people would sell their rations on the black market, usually because something tragic made it necessary. "Minka," Reuben said evenly, "you saw nothing." I nodded. I had to, because if I turned Reuben into my father, he would look the other way. And if Reuben was caught trading that bread for something else, and it was discovered that my father had been in on the theft, he could be punished too. As the cart creaked toward Yakuba Street, with a plume of steam rising from the bread and teasing our nostrils, Reuben disappeared. One minute he was walking behind me, the next he was gone. My father did not comment, which made me wonder if maybe he already knew what I was trying so hard not to tell him. I lied to my father and told him I had to give Daria a book I had borrowed and would meet him at our house before curfew. Instead, I went to the spot in town where I had seen the deals happening between smugglers and thieves, hoping to catch Reuben before he did something stupid. At nightfall, when the sky was gray and blending with the cobblestones, and you could not be sure if what you were seeing was real, those who were desperate moved through the shadows, willing to trade their food, their jewels, their souls. It was easy to find Basha's husband, with his red beard and the loaf of bread wrapped in brown paper. "Reuben," I cried out, "wait." He looked up at me, as did the man with the hollow black eyes who was taking the package from him. One moment the parcel was there, and the next it was hidden, slipped somewhere in the ratty folds of the other man's coat. "Whatever you're doing," I begged, grabbing Reuben's arm, "don't. Basha wouldn't want you to." Reuben shrugged me off. "You're a child, Minka. You don't know anything." But I wasn't a child. There were none left in this ghetto, really. We had all grown up, by default. Even a baby like Maya was not a child, because he would have no memory of a life that wasn't like this one.
"Get rid of the girl," the man hissed, "or the deal's off."
I ignored him. "What could possibly be worth your own life?" Reuben, who had kissed me on the forehead the night he got engaged to Basha and told me he had always wanted a little sister, who had found me a copy of Grimm's Fairy Tales written in German for my last birthday, who had promised me he would interview any boy who dared to ask me out on a date, Reuben shoved me away so hard that I fell down. My woolen stockings tore. Sitting up, I rubbed my knee where I had scraped it on the cobblestones. I watched the man press a small brown packet into Reuben's palm. At the very same instant, there was a shout and a whistle, and suddenly Reuben and the other man were surrounded by three soldiers. "Minka!" Reuben shouted, and he threw the bag at me. I caught it, just as he was shoved to the ground. The butt of a rifle was smacked into the side of Reuben's head, and I started to run. I did not stop, not when I reached the bridge over Zgierska Street, not even when I knew that none of the soldiers was pursuing me. Instead, I flew back home, burst through the doors, and collapsed into my mother's arms. Sobbing, I told her about Reuben. Basha, who was standing in the doorway with a wailing Meyer, started to scream. It was then that I remembered the package I was still clutching. I held out my hand, and my fingers opened like the petals of a rose. My mother cut the twine with a kitchen knife. The paper, waxy and mottled, fell away to reveal a tiny vial of medicine. "What could possibly be worth your own life?" I had pleaded. "His sons." Information in the ghetto traveled now like a wisteria vine, twisted, convoluted, and blooming from time to time with unlikely bursts of color. It was through this network that we learned Reuben had been put in prison. Yet even though Basha went daily to see him, she was not allowed in. My father tried to use every business connection he had had outside the ghetto to find information about Reuben, or better yet, to bring him home. But the connections that had gotten me into Catholic school back then were meaningless now. Unless my father happened to be friends with an SS officer, Reuben was going to remain in jail. It made me think of Daria's policeman, the one from the Stuttgart Ballet. There was no guarantee that he would be in a position to help. And yet, he had been a name in a sea of German uniforms. But Daria had burned his card. And so even that tiny spark of possibility was lost to me. We did not know what would happen to Reuben. Yet earlier that month, Chairman Rumkowski had issued a statement. Thieves and criminals would be sent to do manual labor in Germany. It was the eldest's way of removing the riffraff from our community. And yet, who would ever have thought of Reuben as riffraff? I wondered how many people in prison were actually criminals at all. The thought of Reuben being shipped away left Basha inconsolable, even though she had Meyer, who had improved quickly once he'd started taking the medicine, to think of. One night she slipped into my room. It was just after 3 a.m., and I immediately assumed something was wrong with the baby. "What is it?" I said. "I need your help," Basha said. "Why?" "Because you're smart." It was rare for Basha to admit she needed anything from me, much less my intelligence. I sat up in bed. "You're thinking of doing something stupid," I guessed.
"Not stupid. Necessary."
That reminded me of Reuben selling the bread. Angry, I stared at her. "Do either of you even care that you have a little boy who depends on you? What if you wind up being arrested, too?"
"That's why I'm asking you for help," Basha said.
"Please, Minka." "You're Reuben's wife. If you can't get into the prison to see him, there's nothing I'll be able to do."
"I know," Basha said softly, "but that's not who I'm going to see."
Chaim Rumkowski's reputation in the ghetto sat squarely on the fine line between love and hate. You had to publicly admire the chairman, or your life could be hell, since he was the one who granted favors, housing, and food. But you also had to wonder about a man who had willingly agreed to deal with the Germans, to starve his own people, and to explain away the horrible conditions we were living in, by saying, at least we were alive. There were rumors, too, that Rumkowski had a weakness for pretty girls, which was exactly what Basha and I were counting on. It hadn't been hard to get my mother to watch Mayer by explaining that Basha was once again going to try to get into the prison to see her husband. It made sense, too, that she would want to dress in her best outfit and style her hair to look as pretty as she could for her husband. I didn't lie to my mother. I just neglected to mention that our destination was not the prison, but instead Chairman Rumkowski's office. There was nothing I could say that my sister could not have said herself to talk her way into a private audience with the eldest of the Jews, but I understood why she wanted me there. For courage going in, and for support going out. His office looked palatial compared to the cramped quarters of our apartment or the bakery. He had staff, of course. His secretary, a woman who smelled of perfume instead of grime and smoke like us, took one look at me and flicked a glance at a Jewish policeman standing like a sentry in front of a closed door. "The chairman isn't in," she said. Rumkowski spent a lot of time traveling around the ghetto, having school children paraded around in front of him, giving speeches, officiating at wedding ceremonies, or visiting the Fabriken that he thought would make us indispensable to the Germans. So it was not impossible that he would not be present when Basha and I came to his headquarters, but we had been sitting in the cold for hours and had seen the chairman enter the building, surrounded by an entourage, no more than 15 minutes ago. He was easily recognizable with his shock of white hair and his round black glasses, his heavy wool coat with its yellow star on the sleeve. It was that emblem that had made me grab Basha's hand outside when she shivered as he passed. "You see," I whispered, "in the end, he's no different than you or me." So I looked the secretary in the eye and said, "You're lying." Her eyebrows rose. "The chairman isn't in," she repeated. "And if he were, he would not see you without an appointment. And he does not have any openings for the next month." I knew this too was a lie, because I had heard her on the telephone arrange a meeting with the head of the provisioning department tomorrow morning at 9. I opened my mouth to say so, but Basha elbowed me in the ribs. "I'm sorry," she said, stepping forward and averting her gaze. "I think you may have dropped these." She held out a pair of earrings. I knew that the secretary had not dropped these. They had, in fact, been screwed into my sister's ears when she dressed for our outing. They were a beautiful pair of pearls that had been a wedding gift from Reuben. "Basha," I gasped, "you can't." She smiled at the secretary and spoke through her teeth to me. "Shut up, Minka." The woman pursed her lips, then plucked the earrings out of my sister's hand. "No promises," she said. The secretary walked toward the closed office door. She was wearing silk stockings, which amazed me. I couldn't wait to tell Daria that I had seen a Jew looking just as fine as any German lady. She knocked, and a moment later we heard a deep voice rumbling through the door, telling her to enter. With a glance back at us, she slipped inside. "What are you going to say to him?" Basha whispered. We had decided that I would do all the talking. Basha was there as a pretty distraction, as the dutiful wife, but she was afraid that she would grow tongue-tied if she tried to explain why we were there. I don't even know if we'll get in, I replied. I had a plan. I was going to ask the chairman to set Reuben free in time for his wedding anniversary next week so that he could celebrate with his wife. That way, he would be seen as an advocate of true love. And if Chaim Rumkowski loved anything, it was his own image in the eyes of his people. The door swung open, and the secretary walked toward us. You have 5 minutes, she announced. We started forward, holding hands, but the secretary grasped my upper arm. She can go in, the woman said. Not you. But, Basha looked wildly over her shoulder at me. Beg him, I urged. Get down on your knees. Lifting her chin, Basha nodded and walked through the door. As the secretary sat down again and began to type, I stood nervously in the center of the anteroom. The policeman caught my eye and immediately looked away. 22 minutes after my sister had entered the private office of the eldest of the Jews, she stepped outside. Her blouse was untucked in the back. Her red lipstick, which I had borrowed from Daria, was gone, except for a smear in the left corner. What did he say? I burst out. But Basha linked her arm through mine and hurriedly dragged me out of Rumkowski's office. As soon as we were on the street again, with a bitter wind blowing our hair into a frenzy around our faces, I asked her again. Basha let go of my arm and leaned over in the street, vomiting onto the cobblestones. I held her hair back from her face. I assumed this meant that she had failed to rescue Reuben, which was why I was surprised when she turned to me a moment later, her face still white and pinched, and her eyes blazing. He won't have to go to Germany, she said. The chairman is going to send him to a work camp here in Poland instead. Basha grabbed my hand and squeezed. I saved him, Minka. I saved my husband. I hugged her, and she hugged me back, and then she held me at arm's length. You cannot tell Mama and Papa we came here, Basha said. Promise me. But they'll want to know how... They'll assume that Reuben made a deal on his own, she insisted. They would not want to know that we owe the chairman a debt. This was true. I had heard my father grousing about Rumkowski enough to know that he would not want to be beholden to the man. Later that night, with Meyer asleep between us in the bed, I could hear my sister quietly crying. What's the matter? Nothing. I'm fine. You should be happy. Reuben's going to be all right. Basha nodded. I could see her profile, silvered by the moon, as if she were a statue. She looked down at Meyer then, and touched her finger to his lips, as if she was keeping him quiet or pressing him a kiss. Basha, I whispered, how did you convince the chairman? Just like you told me. A tear slipped down her cheek to land on the sheets between us. I got down on my knees. When Reuben had been sent off to a work camp, Basha and the baby had moved in with us. It was like old times, my sister sleeping in my bed, but now my nephew was caught between us like a secret. Meyer was learning his colors and the sounds made by farm animals he had only seen in pictures. We all talked about what a prodigy he was, how proud Reuben would be of his son when he came home. We talked as if this moment was coming any day now. Reuben didn't write, and we all made excuses for him. He was too tired. He was too busy. He didn't have access to paper and pencil. The postal service was virtually non-existent. Only Daria was brave enough to say what we were all thinking. That maybe the reason Reuben had not written was that he was already dead. In October 1941, Daria and I both got food poisoning. It was not remarkable that this had happened, given the quality of the food, only that it had not happened before, and that we were both still strong enough to drag ourselves out of our sickbeds after 2 days of incessant vomiting. But by then, our delivery jobs had been given away. We reported to Lutomierska Street to be assigned new positions. Standing in line with us was a boy who had gone to our school. His name was Aaron, and he used to unconsciously whistle in class while doing his exams, which always got him in trouble. He had a gap between his front teeth and was so tall that he stood with his shoulders hunched, a human question mark. "I hope they put me anywhere but a bakery," Aaron said. I bristled. "What's wrong with a bakery?" I asked, thinking of my father. "Nothing. It's just too good to be true. Like purgatory. Too much heat in the winter, and food all around you you aren't allowed to eat." I shook my head, smiling. I liked Aaron. He wasn't much to look at, but he made me laugh. Daria, who knew such things, said he fancied me. That's why he'd always happened to be the one holding the door of the school building for me as I was walking out, or accompanied me as far as he could in the ghetto before he had to turn off on the street that led to his own home. Once he had even given me a bit of his bread ration during lunch at school, which Daria said was virtually a proposal of marriage in these times. Aaron was no Herr Bauer, or Josek, for that matter, but sometimes, when I was lying next to Basha and Meyer at night, and they had fallen asleep, I pressed the back of my hand against my lips and wondered what it would be like to kiss him. I was not smitten with him, really, only with the idea that someone might look at a girl with worn clothing and clunky boots and dull ropes of hair, and see, instead, a thing of beauty. There were children as young as 10 in the square, waiting, and elderly people who could not stand without leaning on the person beside them. My parents had coached me on what to say, in the hope that I would be routed into my father's bakery or my mother's tailoring fabrique. Sometimes the officials placing you took into consideration your talents or previous experience. Sometimes they just assigned you at random. Daria grabbed my arm. "We could say we're sisters. Then maybe they'll put us together again." I didn't think it would make a difference. Besides, it was already Aaron's turn. I peered around his skinny frame as the official at the table scrawled something down on a piece of paper and handed it to him. When he turned, he was smiling. "Textiles," he said. "You know how to sew?" Daria asked. Aaron shrugged. "No, but apparently I'm going to learn." "Next!" The voice cut through our conversation. I stepped forward, dragging Daria with me. "One at a time," the man before us said. So I stepped in front of Daria. "My sister and I, we both know how to bake, and sew." He was staring at Daria. Then again everyone stared at Daria. She was that pretty. The man pointed to a truck at the corner of the square. "You'll be on that transport." I started to panic. The people who left the ghetto, like Reuben, did not come back. "Please," I begged, "a bakery, a saddle shop." I thought of the job no one else wanted to do. "I'll dig graves, even. Just please don't send me out of the ghetto." The man looked past me. "Next," he called. Daria started to cry. I'm so sorry, Minka, she sobbed. If we hadn't tried to stay together. Before I could answer, a soldier grabbed her by the shoulder and pushed her into the flatbed of the truck. I climbed in after Daria. The other girls were about our age. Some I recognized from school. Some seemed panicked, others almost bored. No one spoke. I knew better than to ask where we were headed. Maybe I did not want to hear the answer. A moment later, we were driving through the gates of the ghetto, a place I had not left in over a year and a half. I felt it viscerally as the gates were closed behind us again. The air was easier to breathe out here. The colors were brighter, the temperature a tiny bit warmer. It was an alternate reality, and it stunned all 10 of us girls into silence as we bounced and jostled away from our families. I wondered who would tell my parents that I was gone. I wondered if Aaron would miss me, if Meyer would know me if he ever saw me again. I grabbed Daria's hand and squeezed. If we have to die, I said, at least we'll be together. At that, the girl sitting next to Daria laughed. Die? You stupid cow. You're not going to die. I've been on this truck every day for a week. You're just going to the officer's headquarters. I thought about how the man had been staring at Daria and wondered what it was exactly we were supposed to do for the officers. We drove through the streets of the city where I had grown up, but something was different. The details I remembered from my childhood, the boy selling newspapers, the fishmonger with her oversized hat, the tailor coming outside for a smoke and squinting into the sunlight, all those familiar faces were gone. Even the gallows, which had been built by the German soldiers in the square, had been dismantled. It reminded me of a story I had written once about a girl who woke up and found every trace of herself erased from the world as she knew it. A family that didn't know her, a school that had no record of her, a history that had never happened. It was as if I had only dreamed the life I used to lead. 15 minutes later, we pulled through another gate that locked behind us. The barracks of the German soldiers were former government buildings in Łódź. We were shuttled out of the truck and turned over to a broad-shouldered woman with chapped red hands. She spoke in German, but it was clear that some of the other girls already knew the routine because they had been assigned this work detail before. We were each given a bucket and rags, and some ammonia, and told to follow her. From time to time she would stop and direct a girl into a building. Daria and the girl who had called me a cow were sent into a big stone hall with a giant Nazi flag draped from its roof. I followed the woman through several passageways until we reached a residential area with small apartments wedged together like clenched teeth. You, she said in German, you will do all the windows. I nodded and turned the doorknob. This must have been where the German officers lived, because it was not like any other military barracks I had ever seen. There were no bunks or footlockers, but beautifully carved wooden bureaus, and a single bed, its covers still messy. Dishes were stacked neatly in a drying rack beside the sink. On the table was a single plate with a bright purple bloom of jam painting its surface. I started to salivate. I had not had jam in forever. For all I knew, though, someone was watching me through a chink in the wall. Pushing all thoughts of food out of my mind, I picked up the rag in my bucket and the ammonia, and walked toward one of the 8 windows in the apartment. I had never cleaned anything in my life. My mother cooked and cleaned and organized and picked up after me. Even now, Basha was the one who pulled the blanket up on our bed and made tight little corners every morning. I looked at the bottle of ammonia and uncorked its cap, gagging at the smell. Immediately I closed it, my eyes tearing. I sat down at the kitchen table and found myself face to face with that breakfast plate. Very quickly I touched my forefinger to the spot of jam and stuck it in my mouth. Oh, God! My eyes began to tear again, for a very different reason. Every bit of my brain had begun firing in memory of eating my father's rolls, slathered with fresh butter and strawberry preserves that my mother had made, of picking blueberries in the country where Daria's father's factory had been, of lying on my back and imagining that the clouds in the sky were a scooter, a parrot, a tortoise, of having nothing to do, because that's the occupation of a child. That jam tasted like a lazy summer day, like freedom. I was so lost in my senses that I didn't hear the footsteps heralding the approach of the officer, who a second later turned the doorknob and entered his residence. I leaped up, grabbing my bucket so fast that the ammonia tumbled out onto the floor. "Oh!" I cried, falling to my knees to mop up the mess with the rag. He was about my father's age, with silver hair that matched the buttons of his uniform. When he saw me, his eyes flicked over my huddled body. "Finish your work quickly," he said in German, and then, because he didn't expect me to understand, he pointed at the window. I nodded and turned away. I could hear the creak of the chair as he sat down at a desk and began to leaf through papers. With a shaking hand, I uncorked the ammonia bottle again, plugged my nose, and tried to twist the rag into its narrow neck so that I could soak up some of the cleaning fluid. I was able to get just the corner wet. Gingerly, I pressed it up against the window at the dirtiest part, as if I were dabbing a wound. The officer looked up after a few moments. "Schneller," he said tightly. "Faster." I turned around, my heart pounding. "I'm sorry," I replied, babbling in his own language to keep him from getting even angrier than he already was. "I've never done this before." His eyebrows raised. "You speak German?" I nodded. It was my best subject. The officer got out of his chair and walked toward me. By now I was frantic, trembling so hard my knees were knocking. I lifted my hand over my head to ward off the blow that I knew was coming, but instead the soldier plucked the rag from my clenched fist. He poured some ammonia into the rag and wiped the window with long, smooth strokes. The rag came away filthy and black, so he folded it over to a fresh white spot and poured more ammonia onto it. He continued to clean his own window, and when he finished, he picked up a newspaper and began to rub it over the panes of glass. "This dries it without leaving streaks," he explained. "Danke," I murmured, holding out my hand for the rag and the bottle of ammonia, but he just shook his head. He proceeded to finish the other windows until they were spotless, until it seemed as if there was no barrier between the inside of this apartment, where we had entered a strange truce, and the outside world, where I could take nothing for granted. Then he looked at me. "Repeat everything you learned." I rattled off every step of the window-washing process, as if my life depended on it, which maybe it did. Flawlessly, in his mother tongue. When I was finished, the officer was staring at me as if I were a museum specimen he'd never encountered before. "If I were not staring right at you," he said, "I wouldn't know you were not Völkisch. You speak like a native." I thanked him, thinking of all those afternoons I'd spent in conversation with Herr Bauer, and silently winging my gratitude to my former teacher, wherever he was now. I reached for the bucket, intent on finishing the rest of my job in other officers' apartments, before the head cleaning woman came back to collect me, but the soldier shook his head and set it on the floor between us. "Tell me," he said, "can you type?" With one note from the officer who had taught me to wash windows, I was reassigned to a workshop run by Herr Fassbinder, an ethnic German man who was just over 5 feet tall and who employed a great number of young girls, many younger than myself. He called us meine Kleine, my little ones. The children were responsible for stitching the emblems that were sewn onto German uniforms. If, that first day, I shuddered to see 10-year-olds fashioning swastika patches, it became common enough. I was not one of the sewers. Instead, I had been sent to work in Herr Fassbinder's office. My job was to process the orders, to answer the telephones, and to give out the candy that he brought in every Friday for the children. At first, Herr Fassbinder spoke to me only when he needed information from the files, or when he had to dictate a letter and have it typed. But then, one day, Aaron showed up with a few other boys, hauling bolts of cloth that would be cut and stitched according to the orders that had been placed. I think Aaron was as surprised to see me as I was to see him. "Minka," he said as I directed his co-workers to the storage rooms, "you work here?" "In the office," I told him. "Ooh," he teased, "a posh job." I looked down at the skirt I was wearing, which was threadbare at the knees after so much use. "Oh, yes," I joked, "I'm practically royalty." But we both knew how lucky I was. Unlike my mother, who had lost most of her eyesight from sewing in the near dark, or pretty Daria, who was still cleaning at the officer's headquarters and whose graceful dancer's hands were now cracked and bleeding from lye and soap. In comparison, 12 hours at a typewriter in a warm office was a walk in the park. Just then, Herr Fassbinder passed by. He looked from me to Aaron and back to me again. Then he shooed me into the office and instructed the little ones to return to work. I had sat down at my desk to type requisition forms when I realized Herr Fassbinder was standing in front of me. "So," he said, smiling broadly, "you have a boyfriend?" I shook my head. "He's not my boyfriend." "Like I am not your boss."
"He is just a school friend." I was nervous, wondering if Aaron could somehow get in trouble with his employer for talking to me at my own job. Herr Fassbinder sighed heavily.
"Well, then, that is a shame," he said, "because he is very much taken with you." "Ah, look. I have made you blush. You should give the young man a chance."
After that, whenever we needed textile supplies, Herr Fassbinder would specifically request that Aaron be the one to deliver them. And he would conveniently assign me to unlock the storeroom for him, although there were others at the factory who were more suited to that job than a secretary. Afterward, Herr Fassbinder would come to my desk and pepper me for details. He was, I realized, just a matchmaker at heart. Gradually, as we sat together in the little office, he began to confide in me,
He told me of his wife, Liesel, who was so beautiful that the clouds would part when she stepped outside. She could have had her pick of any man, he told me, but she chose him because he knew how to make her laugh. His greatest regret was that they had not had a baby before she died, of tuberculosis 6 years ago. I came to see that all of us in the factory, from the littlest girls to me, were his children.
One day, Herr Fassbinder and I were alone in the office. Work for the embroiderers was halted from time to time because various raw materials had not been delivered. This time, it was thread that had not arrived. Herr Fassbinder went out for a little while, and when he came back, he was flustered. "We need more workers," he barked, more upset than I had ever seen him. I was scared of him for the first time, because I didn't know what we would do with more workers when we couldn't even occupy the girls we already had. The next day, in addition to our usual 150 employees, Herr Fassbinder had recruited 50 mothers with young children. The children were too young to do anything of value in an embroidery shop, so he had them sorting the threads by color. Aaron came by with bolts of white fabric. The textile divisions had been employed to make 56,000 camouflage suits for the Eastern Front in the summer. We would be stitching the insignia to match. I knew, because I processed all the orders, that we hadn't been contracted to do this, and that we had just turned into a glorified daycare center.
"That's not your problem," Herr Fassbinder snapped when I asked him about it.
That week, the announcement was made. 20,000 Jews were to be deported from the ghetto. Chairman Rumkowski had negotiated the number down by half, but lists of the 10,000 who would be leaving were made by ghetto officials. The Roma, who lived in a separate part of the ghetto, were the first. Criminals came second. Then those who didn't have jobs. Such as the 50 mothers who had just recently arrived. Something told me that if Herr Fassbinder had been able to take all 10,000 people on that list into his little fabrik, he would have. The first week of January, all the people who had been put on those lists had received their summonses. Wedding invitations, we called them, with irony. A party no one wanted to attend. 1,000 people were taken each day to the trains that led out of the ghetto. By then, our shipment of thread had arrived. By then, our new employees had settled in and were embroidering insignia as if they'd been born to it. One night, as I was covering my typewriter with its dust cover, Herr Fassbinder asked if my family was all right. It was the first time he had ever spoken of me having a life outside these walls, and I was startled. "Yes," I said.
"None were on the lists?" he asked bluntly.
I realized then that he knew far more about me than I knew about him. For also on these lists were the relatives of those who were Roma, who had no jobs, or who were criminals, such as Rubin. Whatever deal Basha had made with the chairman had been a thorough one. She did not know where her husband was, or if he was still alive, but she had not been recommended for deportation because of his crime. Herr Fassbinder turned out the light so that I could just discern his profile in the moonlight that spilled through the small window of the office. "Do you know where they are being taken?" I blurted, suddenly brave in the darkness.
"To work on Polish farms," he said.
Our eyes met in silence. That was what we had been told about Rubin months ago.
Herr Fassbinder had to know from my expression that I did not believe him.
This war, he sighed heavily. There's no escaping it.
Would you say that to someone with papers? I whispered. Christian ones? I have no idea what made me tell him, a German, my biggest secret, the one I had never even told my parents. But something about this man, and the lengths he had gone to protect children who weren't even his, made me think he could be trusted.
If someone had Christian papers, he said after a long moment, I would tell that person to go to Russia until the war ends.
As I left work that night, I started to cry. Not because I knew Herr Fassbinder was right, or because I knew that I would still never go as long as it meant leaving my family behind, but because, when we were locking up the factory office in the dark, where no one else could see us, Herr Fassbinder had held the door open for me, as if I was still a young lady, and not just a Jew. Although we had all believed that the lists created in January would be a single horrible moment in the history of the war, and although the chairman's speeches reminded us, and the Germans, how indispensable we were as a workforce, only 2 weeks later the Germans demanded more deportees. By now, rumors were running as fast as fire through the factories, nearly paralyzing production, because no one ever heard again from a person who had left on one of the transports. It was hard to believe that someone who had been resettled wouldn't try to get word to his family. I heard, Daria said one morning when we were waiting at one of the soup kitchens for our rations, that they're being killed. My mother was too tired these days to stand for hours in the massive crowds that lined up for food. It sometimes seemed it took more time to get our rations than it did to consume them. My father was still at the bakery, and Basha was picking up the baby from his daycare. They had officially been disbanded, but still operated illegally at many of the fabriken, including Basha's textile factory. That left me with the job of getting the rations, and bringing them back home. At least I had Daria with me to pass the time. How could they possibly kill 1,000 people a day? I scoffed. And why would they, if we're working for them for free? Daria leaned closer to me.
Gas chambers, she whispered.
I rolled my eyes. I thought I was the fiction writer. But even though I thought Daria was telling the wildest tales, there were parts of her story that rang true. Like the fact that now the officials were asking for volunteers and promising a free meal if you went on one of the transports. At the same time, food rations were being cut, as if to persuade anyone who was on the fence about the decision. After all, if you took what Rumkowski said at face value, and could get out of this hellhole, and fill your belly while doing it, who wouldn't step up? But then, there was the new law that made it a crime to hide someone who was on the list for deportation. Or the case of Rabbi Weiss, who had been given the responsibility of finding 300 people in his congregation for the most recent transport. He had refused to give a single name, and when the soldiers came to arrest him, they found him and his wife lying dead on their bed, their hands tightly linked. My mother said it was a blessing that they went at the same time. I couldn't believe she thought I was stupid enough to believe that.
By late March 1942, everyone knew someone who had been deported. My cousin Rivke, Daria's aunt, both of Rubin's parents, my former doctor. It was the season of Passover, and this was our plague. But no amount of lamb's blood would save a household from tragedy. It seemed the only blood that satisfied was that of the families inside. My parents tried to protect me by giving me only limited information about the Aussiedlungen, the roundups. "Be a mensch," my mother told me, "no matter what situation you're in. Be kind to others before you take care of yourself. Make whoever you're with feel like they matter." My father told me to sleep in my boots. It was several hours before I collected the meager store of food that was meant to last us for the next 2 weeks. By then my feet were frozen and my eyelashes were stuck together. Daria blew into her mittens to warm her hands. "At least it's not summer," she said, "less of a chance that the milk is already spoiled." I walked with her as far as I could, until she had to turn down a different street to her apartment. "What should we do tomorrow?" I asked. "Oh, I don't know," Daria said. "Maybe go shopping?" "Only if we can stop for high tea," Daria grinned. "Honestly, Minka, do you ever stop thinking about food?" I laughed and turned the corner. Alone, I walked faster, averting my eyes from the soldiers I passed and even the residents I knew. It was too hard to look at people these days. They seemed so hollow sometimes. I worried that I might fall right inside those empty stairs and never be able to claw my way out. When I reached the apartment, I climbed over the missing wooden stoop step. Daria's family had burned it in December for firewood, and immediately noticed that nobody was home. Or at least, there was no light, no sound, no life. "Hello?" I called out as I walked inside and set the canvas sack with our rations on the kitchen table. My father was sitting on a chair, holding his head in his hands. Blood seeped between his fingers from a wide cut on his forehead. "Papa?" I cried, running to him and pulling his hand away so that I could see the wound. "What happened?" He looked at me, his eyes unfocused for a moment. "They took her," he said, his voice breaking. "They took your mother." It seemed that you didn't even have to be on a list to fill up the necessary quotas for deportation. Or maybe my mother had gotten her wedding invitation and had chosen not to tell us, so we wouldn't worry. We didn't have the whole story. All we knew was that my father had returned from Schul to find the SS in his living room, screaming at my mother and my uncle. Fortunately, Basha had taken Meyer out for some fresh air and wasn't home. When my mother tried to run to my father, he was knocked unconscious with the butt end of a rifle. By the time he came to, she was gone. He told me all this as I cleaned and dressed the cut on his forehead. Then he sat me down on a chair and knelt at my feet. I could feel him unlacing my boots. He slipped the left one from my foot and smacked the heel against the floor until it wiggled loose, then pulled it apart so that the little compartment with the stash of gold coins was revealed. He reached inside and took out the money. "You will still have the rest in the other boot," he said, as if he were trying to convince himself that he was doing the right thing. After he put my boot back together again, he took my hand and led me outside. For hours we walked the streets, trying to ask anyone we saw if they knew
where those who had been rounded up had gone. People shied away from us, as if misery was contagious. The sun sank lower and lower until it broke like a yoke over the rooftops. "Papa," I told him, "it's nearly curfew." But he didn't seem to hear me. I was terrified. I thought this was surely a death wish. If he couldn't find my mother, he didn't want to be here anymore. It didn't take long for us to be confronted by two SS soldiers who were patrolling. One of them pointed at my father and started yelling, "Get off the street!" When my father kept walking toward him, holding out the coins in his hand, the soldier pointed his gun. I threw myself in front of my father. "Please," I begged in German, "he isn't thinking clearly." The second soldier stepped forward and put his hand on his comrade's arm, lowering the gun. I started to breathe again.
"Was ist los?"
he asked. "What's the matter?" My father looked at me, his expression so raw that it hurt to stare into his eyes.
"Ask them where they took her."
So, I did. I explained that my mother and my uncle had been collected from our home by soldiers, and that we were trying to find them. Then my father spoke in a universal language, pressing the gold coins into the gloved hand of the soldier. In the light from the street lamp, the soldier's response had a shape. The words swelled in the space between us.
"Verschwenden Sie nicht Ihr Geld,"
he said, dropping the coins onto the pavement. He jerked his head toward our apartment, a reminder again that we were breaking curfew.
"My gold is as good as anyone else's," my father called after them, angrily, as the soldiers moved down the street. "We will find someone else, Minka," he promised. "There has to be a soldier in the ghetto who is willing to be paid for information."
I knelt, picking up the coins that winked against the cobblestones. "Yes, Papa," I said. But I knew this wasn't true, because I understood what the soldier had said.
"Don't waste your money."
The day after my mother disappeared, I went to work. There were several girls missing. Others cried as they embroidered. I sat at my typewriter, trying to lose myself in requisition forms, but failing miserably. When I had messed up for the fifth time in a row, I finally banged my fist on the keys so that they all flew up at once, printing a line of nonsense, as if the whole world had started to speak in tongues. Herr Fassbinder came out of his inner office to find me sobbing.
"You are upsetting the other girls," he said.
And sure enough, I could see some of them staring at me through the window that separated my desk from the factory floor.
"Come here."
I followed him into his office and sat down the way I did when I took dictation. He did not pretend that he didn't know about the Aussiedlung of the previous evening, and he did not tell me to stop crying. Instead, he gave me his handkerchief.
"Today you will work in here," he announced.
And he left me, closing the door behind him. For 5 days, I moved like a zombie at work, and then like a ghost at home, silently picking up after my father, who had stopped eating and speaking. Basha fed him spoonfuls of broth the way she fed Meyer. I had no idea how he made it through his bakery shift, but I assumed his men were covering whatever labor he could not do on his own. I was not sure what was worse, having my mother vanish in an instant, or losing my father by degrees. One night, as I walked home from the Fabrik, I could feel a shadow behind me, breathing on my neck, like a dragon.
Every time I turned around, though, I saw nothing but haggard neighbors trying to get home and close their doors before any misery could slip over the threshold. Still, I could not shake the feeling that I was being followed, and the fear rose, doubling, quadrupling, filling every last space in my mind, the way my father's dough swelled, if given enough time. My heart was pounding by the time I burst through the door of the apartment, which felt wrong now that both of my cousins were gone, as if we were squatters instead of guests. "Basha!" I yelled out. "Papa!" But it was just my dumb luck. I was alone. I unwound my scarf and unbuttoned my coat, but left them on because there was no heat in the apartment. Then I slipped a paring knife into my sleeve, just in case. I heard something break in another room. The noise had come from the only bedroom in the apartment, the one that had been occupied by my cousins when we first moved in. I crept down the hallway as quietly as I could in my heavy boots and peered through the doorway. One of the window panes had been broken. I looked around to see if a rock had been thrown, but there was nothing on the floor but glass. Kneeling, I began to sweep it up carefully with my palms, using my skirt as a dustpan. There. I hadn't imagined it. That shadow that flickered at the corner of my eye. Leaping to my feet, so that the glass spilled back onto the floor, I yanked aside the bedroom door to find the tall, thin boy who had broken the window to hide inside. Brandishing the knife from my sleeve, I held him at bay. "We have nothing for you," I cried. "No food, no money. Go away." His eyes were wide, his clothes torn and ragged. Unlike the rest of us who were starving, he had visible muscles bulging beneath his shirt. He took a step forward. "Stop, or I'll kill you," I yelled, and in that moment, I believed that I could. "I know what happened to your mother," he said. Who had dreamed up a novel about an undead upyur who fell in love with a human girl, could not believe the fantasy this boy spun with words. His name was Hersch, and he had been with my mother on the freight train that left the